Good morning. After he pled the fifth, a Senate committee votes to hold Dr. Anthony Fauci in contempt of Congress. The Washington Post tells us what it all means.
There are real stakes here for Fauci. Contempt of Congress, if you're convicted, can land you in jail. It can land you with huge fines.
President Trump denies growing reports of shortages in U.S. military supplies, and why the investigation into Nancy Guthrie's kidnapping went so badly wrong. It's Friday, August 7th. I'm Gideon Resnick in for Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. The Senate Homeland Security Committee voted to hold Dr. Anthony Fauci in contempt of Congress yesterday, a move that sets up a major battle in the courts over rare, untested legal arguments. Republican Chair Rand Paul held the vote after Fauci invoked the Fifth Amendment in a recent appearance on Capitol Hill. It passed 8-7 along party lines. If prosecutors seek an indictment and convince a grand jury, Fauci would face charges of criminal contempt, and a conviction could lead to fines and a prison sentence of up to a year. At his Senate appearance last week, Fauci accused Paul of pursuing a, quote, unhinged obsession with prosecuting him. Paul, meanwhile, said that Fauci had nothing to fear, as former President Biden had given him a preemptive pardon following Republican threats.
Dr. Fauci faced no risk of federal prosecution. All he had to do was tell the truth. We are voting on whether a witness who has received the benefit of a sweeping federal pardon can be ordered by this committee to answer questions and then defy that order without consequence.
In a statement, Fauci's lawyer called the vote a crude political stunt intended to punish him for exercising his constitutional rights.
What happens with all of this could redefine the limits of Congress's power to compel testimony from witnesses who have presidential pardons, especially for partial periods of time like this one.
Analyst Roy covers Congress for The Washington Post.
Fauci says that he does have the right to invoke the Fifth Amendment because he could still face charges, potentially, for things that were said or done outside of that window. The vulnerability here for Fauci could potentially be both for things that happened before and after that period of time that the pardon covers, or other kinds of charges not on the federal level, state or local charges.
The U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C., Jeanine Pirro, will now have to decide whether to pursue charges. If so, she would need to persuade a grand jury to secure an indictment. It would amount to a unique constitutional fight that balances Fauci's Fifth Amendment rights against congressional power.
The U.S. Attorney for D.C. would assess the evidence and potentially could seek a criminal indictment. They don't have to, though. So the question really is, what happens from here? And as we've seen with Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro, there are real stakes here for Fauci. Contempt of Congress, if you're convicted, can land you in jail. It can land you with huge fines. It could potentially open him up to real consequences.
In total, Fauci invoked the Fifth Amendment more than 100 times during last week's hearing, frustrating Republicans like Josh Hawley.
Let's try something. What day of the week is it today?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
What color tie are you wearing?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
Liz Roy said that more action against Fauci is likely on the way.
Republicans are pursuing different avenues to get Fauci to answer questions, and we will see where all of this leads, but it's clear that it's not over yet. The committee chairman, Rand Paul, has been locked into this for years. He and other Republicans believe that Fauci has not been honest about the origins of COVID-19 and the government's role in funding virus research. They think that Fauci was involved with a lab leak cover-up. Fauci has completely and repeatedly denied that.
Democrats allege the focus on the 85-year-old retired Fauci is a political stunt that's not meant to gather serious information about the pandemic. Here's Connecticut's Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal at the hearing on Wednesday.
There is a need for a serious inquiry to answer questions arising from the pandemic. We need to hear not only from Dr. Fauci, but from others in the course of a bipartisan, nonpartisan inquiry. This kind of show trial is no way to elicit the important information that the country needs to know.
Liz Roy said this fracture is emblematic of how congressional committees conduct business in this era.
This is a perfect example of how bipartisan congressional investigation into valid questions, how COVID started and how it was handled, have completely devolved into political fracture and spectacle.
A DOJ spokesperson said yesterday that they had received the referral and will work with the Senate accordingly. President Trump dismissed growing reports that the U.S. military is running low on key munitions yesterday, amid claims that it was affecting the strategy in Iran and relations with key members of his own cabinet. Various outlets have cited senior sources that supplies have dwindled. Yesterday, The Washington Post and CNN reported that Trump demanded answers about why he had been apparently misled on the shortages, venting his frustration at Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Sources told CNN that Trump had been made aware of potential problems and wasn't blindsided. The administration denied these reports, as did Trump on social media, who has reportedly also ordered a leak probe. Yesterday, reporters asked him why the Pentagon had requested more funding to restock weapons if supplies were healthy.
Well, because we need more all the time. I mean, we need more. Look, we gave tremendous amount to Ukraine. We're watching that very closely, but we have certain types which are very powerful and very good, and we have an unlimited supply, and so we're in great shape. But with that being said, we always want more. We have to have more.
Mike Stone is a reporter at Reuters. Sources told him and his colleagues that the United States has used virtually all of its long-range precision missiles during the conflict with Iran.
The United States has used an absolute ton of their ground-launched missiles used by the Army. So the ATACMS missile and the PrSM missile, that's what has come up as a shortage. Now, there's a variety of other missiles that the United States uses, but they're mainly defensive.
Those defensive missiles include Patriots and THAAD systems. The U.S. fired more than 1,000 of those missiles in the first month of the war alone. A shortage overall, Stone says, means the U.S. might need to recalculate some of its positions.
So the net consequence of running out of this magazine of weapons now is the United States is not really able to project power in the 250 to 500 mile range. That means you need to have weapons that are air launched or weapons that are sea launched that are quite a bit more costly with 1,000 mile ranges. And so you're making more costly decisions each time you push a button to fire a weapon.
Several outlets reported that Trump called off a massive planned offensive inside of Iran because of warnings from military leaders regarding short missile supplies. Analysts told Reuters that manufacturers are working at record pace to produce other types of munitions. But a prolonged war means a shortage could hit those supplies as well. And it could have consequences for other countries, too. Ukraine is a recipient of ATACMS missiles, and they've played a key role in their attacks into Russian territory. Stone said that as the U.S. works to ramp up weapons production, the current situation in the Gulf gives Iran a slight advantage while driving the bill for the conflict even higher.
I really feel as though the United States is in a tough position. The news of the weaponry being expended only strengthens Iran's hand in negotiations. But it is true that the United States can utilize much, much more weaponry and has a lot more in its stores and magazine depth, but it's just going to cost the taxpayer much, much more.
It's been 6 months since Nancy Guthrie, the mother of the longtime Today Show co-host Savannah Guthrie, was kidnapped from her home outside Tucson, Arizona. And investigators have very little to show for their work so far. There hasn't been a credible lead for months, and no charges have been filed. The last ransom note, sent in February but released to the public last week, reads that the kidnappers had never meant to hurt Guthrie, but she had died shortly after being abducted and was now, quote, buried in nature. Savannah Guthrie released a video last week telling the kidnappers that it's not too late for them to return Nancy to her family.
I'm asking you, begging you, to do the right thing now. Make the right choice. Help us find her. Tell us where to look for her. I truly believe it is never too late to do the right thing. Help us bring this situation to an end.
Authorities have not said whether Nancy Guthrie is alive at this point, and they're still investigating the case.
And it's been a captivating case. Like, how can someone disappear without a trace, especially the mother of one of the most recognizable women in America?
Valerie Borlein is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal.
There's just cameras and digital devices recording every minutia and every second of every day. And so it seems impossible to believe in this time of digital surveillance that a person could just disappear.
Borlein and her colleagues have been looking into what's gone wrong in the investigation into Nancy Guthrie's disappearance. And she says she believes the case has gone unsolved for a few reasons.
Bad luck, bad calls, and kind of bad relations, bad communications, kind of all mixed together.
A number of those bad calls came in the immediate response. The Journal reports that for several hours, law enforcement seemed to be running both a missing persons investigation and a criminal investigation. And the sheriff's department failed to immediately seal off Guthrie's property as a crime scene.
And you'll hear criminologists say that a crime scene is like a stove. It gets colder as soon as it's turned off.
At the time, investigators didn't realize the alleged perpetrator had been standing on Guthrie's front porch. And they initially failed to pay attention to some dried blood on the porch, assuming that it had no connection to the kidnapping.
And so losing that key evidence and allowing people to walk around or touch things, the law enforcement said they regret having done that. So there were some calls that led to some missed opportunities.
Perhaps the biggest break in the case to date came from Guthrie's doorbell camera. The sheriff's department initially struggled to recover the video from her camera, which had been ripped out by the time authorities arrived to the scene. The FBI worked with partners in the private sector to recover the footage, which included video of a man in a mask carrying a gun and a backpack, walking up to Guthrie's door the night of her disappearance. Usually releasing an image of a suspect can lead to breakthroughs, but that didn't happen here.
There was no big break in the case from that video footage, right? And that's the kind of footage that broke the Boston bombing case open, that broke the Luigi Mangione case open. So there were bad luck.
Investigators also got unlucky with Guthrie's community. Many of her neighbors had smart doorbells as well, but their cameras didn't capture any useful footage, in part because their community has strict limits on artificial light at night, meaning there are no street lights.
So it's pitch black. When the sun set that night, it was the blackest darkness you can think of that time of year. And there just wasn't usable doorbell footage from any of the neighbors. So there just haven't been the digital footprint you might expect.
The Journal reports the investigation has also gotten messy as a result of bad communication between local authorities and federal authorities. The sheriff has said local authorities were working with the FBI right away. Meanwhile, the FBI has accused the local sheriff's office of freezing them out of the investigation for days.
Cash Patel, the FBI director, has said, look, we could have gotten more. We could have been closer to solving this, but we are boxed out of the early days of the investigation. The sheriff, Chris Nanos, says, look, you know, if he feels that way, he needs to call me. I've never talked to him. I don't know why he would say this.
After releasing the ransom notes, the Pima County Sheriff appealed for anyone who might recognize the patterns of word choice, syntax, and phraseology to come forward. Here are a few other stories we're following today. Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell was discharged from a rehabilitation center nearly 2 months after he was first hospitalized following a fall. The 84-year-old senator said in a statement that he will continue his recovery from home. He didn't provide a timeline for his return to the Senate, which will soon begin a five-week summer recess. Questions over McConnell's health have mounted since his June hospitalization, prompting calls for more medical information to be released, including from his state's Democratic governor, Andy Beshear. McConnell stepped down as Senate Republican leader in 2024 and plans to retire in January after serving 7 terms in the Senate. President Trump renewed his attempts to curtail birthright citizenship by signing a pair of executive orders yesterday. They aim to exclude children of staff working for foreign governments while in the U.S. and the babies of mothers who lie about their reasons for visiting the country while pregnant. It's not clear how these will be enforced, and it comes only weeks after the Supreme Court ruled that his birthright citizenship policies were unconstitutional. And finally, a news anchor at a Fox affiliate in Memphis experienced every TV journalist's worst nightmare.
Sleeping Beauty over here. It is time for Sunshine Snaps. We love your phone.
Dominique Dillon, the mother of 2 young children, briefly fell asleep during an episode of Good Morning Memphis last Wednesday. She said she was mortified when the moment went viral, but it's led to an outpouring of support from working mothers around the country who understand sleep-deprived early mornings. She spoke to NBC's Today on Wednesday.
What I love so much about this situation is that it shows the good side of humanity.
Yeah.
And that people understand, like, what I'm going through as a mother. There's so many other mothers out there who, and parents in general, who work hard. They show up to work, they give 100%, and then they go home. And that's like a whole nother full-time job as well. And they're giving 100% to their families.
You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, stick around for the latest episode of Apple News in Conversation. This week, guest host David Green sat down with New Yorker staff writer Burkhard Bilger to talk about his recent reporting on ticks and a particularly nasty tick-borne illness that's been spreading across the country.
You can have hives, rashes, shortness of breath, your tongue and your throat can swell up. You can have full anaphylactic shock. You know, there have been people who've died from this. One of the tricky things about this is that it takes a while for the body to digest. And so often you'll eat a steak at 7 in the evening, 8 in the evening, and you won't feel any symptoms of the allergy until 3 in the morning. And so people often don't make the connection.
If you're listening in the podcast app, you can follow Apple News in Conversation to find that episode. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll be back with the news on Monday.